Welcome to another edition of In You All Along here on WMFO in Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. My name is Pete, and I will be with you for the next hour. We have kind of a special edition this week of In You All Along. It's both my sadness and pleasure to be bringing you a show devoted to looking back at the work of Joe Frank, who very sadly passed away this week after a long battle with cancer. Joe Frank was kind of the cream of the crop of innovation in radio, in my opinion, for a long stretch of my life. And he was one of the folks that caught my ear, I guess you'd say, many years ago. Pulled me in. Gave me a taste of the delicious poison of radio, which I've been addicted to ever since. His radio monologues were something that I had heard of without even realizing that I had already heard them. And he was kind of a unique talent. I'm going to let him speak a little bit better for him than I am before I ruin the moment. So here you go. Enjoy this taste of the legendary Joe Frank.
Laughed nervously, and they began to talk, and she asked him if sometimes, in his dreams, he had full use of his arms and legs. And he said, yes. But then he'd wake up and re-experience the shock of what had happened to him. And he told her about the accident, which had happened when he was skiing. He was racing down to the bottom of a mountain because the ski lift was going to close down soon, and he wanted to take one last run. And he made it down just in time to catch the last lift up. If he'd arrived 30 seconds later, he would have missed it. And on that last run, overtired, he failed to control his skis and ran into the root of a tree that caught the tip of one of his skis, and it flipped him up in the air. And he knew, as he was spiraling and falling, that there was no way he was going to be able to get up from what was about to happen. And he landed on his neck and heard a crack. She felt nervous talking to him and forced herself to stay present and open with him. She asked him about the people he loved, and he told her he'd been married at the time and had two kids. And she asked if they were still together, and he said no. But he wasn't angry at his wife because she tried her best, had stayed with him for about 8 months. But he could no longer make love to her, and he couldn't contribute to their marriage. So he didn't blame her. And that, actually, he'd been relieved when she'd left him, because he no longer had to pretend to be anything he could no longer be. And although he'd been terribly depressed by it all, he felt more comfortable being around people who were like him. And now he lived in a home with a group of other handicapped men. And he asked her what she did, and she told him about her job. And he asked if he could write her there, and she said yes. She would love to get a letter from him. And she wrote out her address at work for him and put the paper in his pocket. And then he gave her his address. And when she began walking again, he rolled along beside her. And they said goodbye at the end of the bridge. And he wheeled himself up a road to where there was a bleak-looking housing project with a wheelchair ramp leading up to its door. And she watched him, thinking she'd seen the face of God. She'd been contemplating her death, feeling so unattached to anyone, so unloved. And then this man had come to her with his friendly, beautiful spirit, and had been so happy to meet her when she was so unhappy to be her. And a few weeks later, she wrote him and told him how much their meeting had meant to her, and she thanked him. But he never did write her back. And even if he had written, it would have been too late anyway.
So Sunday morning, he came. He was right on time at 10 o'clock. And he drove up in this very nice-looking station wagon and looked really new, which I later found out was rented. And he looked very, very nice. He looked just like he did on his tape, only he was dressed in white jeans, and he had this wonderful shirt, sports shirt open, and he was nicely built. I mean, he had a nice chest, and he had nice, strong arms, and the three of us, it was funny, because we were standing at the window, and we were watching him come up the path, and I don't know who was most excited. Wendy was jumping up and down. I had to try to calm her down, and Diane was, I guess Diane, well, she has her own way. And then the kids wanted to go answer the door, and I said, no, I'll I'll answer it. And he rang the doorbell, and I went to the door, and he introduced himself, and I introduced myself, and then the girls were just, you know, sort of pushing past, and I introduced them, and then he started taking out gifts for the girls, and they were really lovely, lovely toys, and I could tell they liked him right away. And then we put all the food and stuff and toys in this station wagon, and we all got in, and kids got in the back and started playing with their toys, and all the way there we had a wonderful time, because he was joking with the girls, and he had a really nice sense of humor, and he was making them laugh all the time. And then we sang songs. We sang all these songs that we used to sing when we were little, and the kids still sing, and like Old MacDonald and Row, Row, Row Your Boat, and we sing 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall, 99 Bottles of Beer, and before we knew it, we were at the beach. And we all piled out and took the picnic stuff down, and it was wonderful, because it was a really beautiful beach, and there weren't too many people, and it was late in the summer, and it wasn't real hot, and but it was a beautiful sunny day. The water was a little too cold for me, but he took the kids, and they went and splashed around like wild things, and had a wonderful time. And he would carry them on his shoulders, and they'd be splashing each other and playing ball, and all just generally playing, having a wonderful time. And then they built this big sand castle, and with walls all around it and turrets. And he found things to put on it, like bits of tinfoil for flags, and pieces of seaweed, and old shells, and beautiful things. It was very, very creative and very beautiful. And the kids just had a wonderful time. And then we spread out all the food. And he had the cooler, and he had some really fabulous white wine in it. And he and I had a little sip of wine, and then there were soft drinks for the girls, and we ate all the food. And then he said there was this wonderful ice cream stand down the boardwalk away, and asked us if we wanted some. And of course the kids were very excited, and he started saying, "Ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream." And he said, "Well, come on, we'll go up and we'll get some." And he asked me if I wanted them to bring me back some ice cream, and I said no. And he said, "Okay, well, we'll be right back." And then the girls each took one of his hands, and they weren't shy with him at all. And I watched them walking up toward the boardwalk with him, and it was really nice to see them holding his hands and walking that way. You could see that they really needed that they really needed to have a man. They responded to him so totally that it was really beautiful to watch. And then I just turned back and I lay down and closed my eyes and took in some sun. The sun was really warm, and there was a cool breeze. It wasn't too hot. It was just perfect. And I was lying there with my eyes closed, and I was thinking, boy, this could be a whole new life. Oh, it just seemed like my life was going to change. Then a little time passed, and I just sort of turned over and looked up the beach toward the boardwalk to see if they were coming back. couldn't see them. So I got up and I looked toward the ice cream place, and I could see the ice cream place, but I couldn't see anybody standing in front of it. So I looked up and down the beach, and the beach was just almost deserted. I didn't really think anything had happened, but I got this funny, scared feeling. So I put on my shoes, and I left everything else there, and I just ran up to the boardwalk. And I went to the ice cream place. And there was a man there, and I said, "Have you seen a man and two little girls?" And he said they'd gotten some ice cream cones, and I asked him where they'd gone, and he said that he thought they went that way, and he pointed down the boardwalk. And so I ran down the boardwalk, and I ran all the way to where the boardwalk stops, and there's nothing but sand there, and then dunes, and I was looking on the beach and on the boardwalk, and they weren't there. So by this time I was really terrified, and I was crying, and I started running back in the other direction, and that's when I thought of the parking lot. So I ran down the other side of the boardwalk to the parking lot, and almost all the cars were gone, and so was the station wagon.
Was an excerpt from a Joe Frank 1987 work called Rent a Family. Rent a Family was a three-part show. One of the few real long monologues of his that Joe did not narrate himself. That one was by Barbara Somers, written by Joe Frank, actually turned into a play for the stage at some point. Prior to that, we heard a piece from Windows, which is one of my favorite of Joe's shows. Windows was from 1999, when Joe was doing a series at KCRW in LA called The Other Side. And it delves into the inside and the outside and the many sides of love. And it is gut-wrenching from beginning to end, as so many of his stories are. I was in the car, as I think I may have alluded to with my sister and my mother and my friend Mark one Thanksgiving in college. And we were driving across Connecticut, flipping through the radio dial. I grew up listening to the radio on long car rides, being sucked in by the many famous pre-politics talk radio personalities that were a big staple of AM radio, at least in the 80s. And so I was tuned. I was tuned into listening to people talk for a long time on the radio. Can you tell? But we discovered his show, The Dictator, Joe's show. It was a three-part, another three-part performance from 1993 from his series In the Dark. And The Dictator was a narration by a man deep underground talking about the revolution and war he was orchestrating on the surface. And you didn't know if he was delusional or if he knew what you didn't. And that was the beauty of it. He painted a picture, a perspective of one voice. And from then I was hooked. Let's get back to a little bit more of Joe Frank.
Simply stepping into a booth and a few seconds later appearing at your place of work, or at a lake hundreds of miles away, or in a distant country. The nature of travel would change entirely. So let me explain the concept of teleportation. Teleportation works because the body, being made up of molecules, contains a code for the assembly, disassembly, and reassembly of these molecules. Now, each molecule is represented by a series of electrical charges that in turn can be represented by a computerized binary code. So what one does is one makes a mathematical formula that is the equivalent of a map of all of the molecules that comprise the person who is being teleported, and by performing an inversion function, decomposes the structure, converts it into a computer code that is transmitted by radio wave to a distant receiver that reassembles the object by interpreting and reverting the mathematical formula. So in this manner, the individual can be reconstructed anywhere else in the world. And and I decided to develop this technology because I felt it would immediately supplant air travel, travel by automobile, public transportation, that people could go to work simply by stepping into a small teleportation cabinet at home and appear at a similar receiving cabinet at work. And eventually, it would become as universal as barcodes on products. There would be both transmitting and receiving booths everywhere. So you could go anywhere you wanted in an instant. And this would save enormous amounts of time for everybody, because now it would no longer take you 6 hours to fly from Los Angeles to New York. You could, at the speed of light, be transmitted there. So I established a company called Nextrans, and what I did was hire a group of Nobel laureate scientists, and I put them together with a Silicon Valley team of brilliant computer scientists and mathematicians, physicists, and biologists, and after a year and a half, we developed a prototype that could disassemble a chimpanzee and transmit it to a receiving station across town, where it would be reassembled. And then we increased the distance from downtown Burbank to an office building in Kuala Lumpur. And so having accomplished that, we then had our first human testing done. But unfortunately, we experienced some serious problems with our first volunteer, such that his mouth and alimentary canal were reversed, so that his mouth was lodged between his buttocks and his anus was located between his lips. And he had fingernails for teeth and an eyeball coming out of his navel, and his ears were attached to the palms of his hands, and his nose was where his genitalia had been, and his male member depended from the space between his eyes, which was very disconcerting for him, particularly in the presence of very beautiful, scantily clad women. And in order to deal with this problem, we had constructed for him a face sock, which through a cunning series of straps and Velcro attachments preserved his modesty. So right away we had to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to address this problem. And unfortunately, this one gentleman brought a lawsuit against us, even though he'd volunteered and signed a waiver, demanding tens of millions of dollars in damages for pain and suffering and for restitution of lost wages. So more research and experiments were conducted, and then one of our very own scientists, Dr. Harumi Suzuki, volunteered and placed himself in a transmitter. And during the time that he was being transmitted, there was a disturbance on the surface of the sun that disrupted radio waves, which happens from time to time. And in so doing, Dr. Suzuki remained disassembled and forever part of the electrical atmosphere surrounding the Earth. And we are still working on bringing him back. We have radio telescopes searching for him. The man is lost, and we have to find him. And we're going to find him. But in the meantime, we had to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So that was another enterprise that failed. But I was not daunted. I was bloodied, but unbowed. When you have vision and ideas and imagination, when you believe in yourself, defeat is nothing more than the foundation for victory. It's nothing more than a signpost on the road to triumph. Inspired by the concept of an undersea city, the city of Atlantis that flourished at the bottom of the ocean, I decided to construct a huge industrial complex underwater because I determined that there was insufficient land left to support this kind of enterprise. And it was built by the same technology that constructed the Channel Tunnel that connects England to France under the floor of the sea. My industrial park harnessed the heat that is resident in the core of the Earth and converted it into energy to run giant steam turbines that turned dynamos and produced huge amounts of electrical power. There were vast fields of cracking towers surrounded by immense implosion tanks with pipes and feeder conduits and walking beam piston-driven ratchet reciprocators that were used for the compression of lipid-based protein products. There were Bessemer furnaces for the smelting of raw ore products and mercury refinement cascaders, as well as lithographic tumbling engines. There were foundries and great steel smelting plants generating building materials. There were shipyards constructing gigantic ocean-going tankers, aircraft manufacturing facilities generating 747-style Airbuses, and factories producing everything from dishwashers to inline skates to video monitors to keyboards. We also reconverted fossil fuel-based materials into component parts for recycling, and there were great industrial computer-driven looms that produced vast quantities of woven goods. And we also produced chemicals, components for communications and military gear, fuel for internal combustion engines, raw materials for the construction of highways and urban infrastructure, semiconductor chips, high explosives, antibiotics, filaments for light bulbs, nutritional supplements, and super hybrid wheat seeds. And we built vast subterranean apartment structures for the workers and their families with internal courtyards, recreational facilities, exercise rooms, malls with multiplex movie theaters and concert halls and public parks. But unfortunately, there were some problems with water seepage and an occasional flood. A wall was once breached and a great cascade of fishes, seaweed, mud, clams, and lobsters overran an entire sector of the city. There were electrical power outages, boilers exploded, and people drowned. All the result of engineering design defects caused, admittedly, by our desire to build these structures in a timely manner, in accordance with the business plan that the investors had been promised. So we'd made some compromises which resulted in an inevitable but regrettable loss of life. And ultimately, when the French conducted their series of underwater nuclear tests only a few miles away, it caused havoc. There were cave-ins, walls collapsed, entire sectors were flooded. Thousands of people perished from the poisoned atmosphere and from drowning, or were electrocuted or asphyxiated. And panicked mobs ran pillaging and looting through some of the commercial sectors. So the entire industrial park had to be shut down because people barely got out of there with their lives. And this was followed by yet another congressional hearing where I was branded some kind of international business criminal, which I must say I found personally offensive. But I picked myself up, I dusted myself off, I clapped my hands together, rubbed my palms, looked upward, and moved on. Because you only go around once in life, and you can't let a setback set you back. Every day when you get up, you've got to say, this day is the first day of the most amazing lifetime I will ever lead. Nothing can stop you. Nothing can thwart your efforts. The wind is always at your back. Yes, swim the vast ocean, leap from the greatest height, climb the tallest tree, ascend the vertical wall. This is a race you can win. So snatch the kill from the other lions. It's in your heart, in your mind, in your marrow. It's in the nucleus of every one of your cells. Success is written in your DNA. And if not, it's just around the corner, down the street, over the hill, and beyond the horizon. So take that walk in the sun, because you were born to win. You're the master of your own destiny. You have nothing to gain but gain itself.
Came in earlier this morning. I woke up fighting the beginning stages of possibly a cold coming on. And it's never a good feeling, and you never feel quite right, and you never feel like you exactly know what you're doing. And that's kind of how I felt starting today's show, especially when I was here up against what I would call the best in the business, the guy that kind of laid the standard, in my opinion, for pulling in listeners on the radio. So I was a little out of it, away, a little off, until I just heard that excerpt from Joe's 1996 program, An Enterprising Man. And I remembered why I love this, why I love Joe Frank's work, why I love the radio, why I love a good story, especially why I love something absurd presented as matter of fact. Those were two little passages from An Enterprising Man, which is a story, an hour-long program told from the point of view of an obscenely wealthy businessman who, one after another, creates these massive schemes that go terribly awry and sees nothing but a personal challenge in these failures that have disastrous results for untold numbers of people. A little realistic in some ways, and on others, just a beautiful work of fiction. You know, Joe, in his last days, was kind of going it alone, was no longer on the radio, and was producing his own works. And you can go to joefrank.com and listen to some of them, including, I believe, An Enterprising Man in its entirety. If you get a free account, you can get many more shows to listen to if you subscribe, which I also strongly recommend. But yeah, that's one of my favorites, hands down. Before An Enterprising Man, we heard an excerpt. Yeah, no, that was the only thing. That's the only thing in that set. So we're going to pick things up right where we left off. A little more of the man, the legend, Joe Frank.
Sometimes when he's out walking, he wanders into a drugstore and browses through magazines.
magazines, looks at clocks, cassette players, and radios, locked behind plate glass, and tries on different pairs of sunglasses. The sunglasses he now wears he stole from the drugstore on the corner. He put them on one day, looked at himself in the mirror, liked them, and continued to wander around the store wearing them, the price tag dangling down over his nose, until he finally walked out. Once he tried on a pair of jeans in a dressing room, tore off the plastic tag that sets off the alarm, put his own jeans on over them, walked to the front to pick up the bags he checked, flirted with a sales girl, and left. Sometimes he goes to a large, busy luncheonette, orders scrambled eggs, pancakes, bacon, sausages, home-fried potatoes, toast, and coffee, eats his meal, gets a bill for it, moves to another seat at the counter, and orders coffee and a Danish. Then, at the cashier, he pays the amount on the second check. One afternoon, he found a purse with $50 in credit cards, and he pocketed the money and sold the cards to a friend. It happened while he was playing the ukulele in a department store. He wore a t-shirt with the store's logo on it and sang the store's theme song. He was posted next to the gift shop and managed over a period of a few weeks to steal brass paperweights, leather-bound address books, calendars, pens, and boxes of stationery. Then, for a while, he had a job raising money for a symphony orchestra. He sat at one of about 20 tables with beige telephones in a fluorescent-lit room and called season ticket holders, subscribers to the monthly magazine, and people who'd bought a gift from the orchestra catalog. He worked from 8 to 11 p.m. at $4.50 an hour, sitting in a group of middle-aged women, college students, unemployed actors, failed pianists, and people who claimed they were businessmen, professors, and lawyers, who for one reason or another were between engagements. There were also a few street people. One of them, a black man whose eyes would sometimes roll up into his head in the middle of a phone call, sat at a desk pointing his forefinger and squinting as if he were aiming a pistol. Then he would depress his thumb, shooting down his co-workers one by one. When you go into a subway station, you enter a hole in the ground. Every sound echoes. You feel as if you're in an altered state of consciousness. Time seems to stand still, yet your sense of it is heightened. You look around and see that people's behavior is similar to that of animals in cages. Some pace absently up and down, while others sit on benches or lean against a wall or a pillar, staring blankly into space. The platform is dimly lit. There are tile walls, concrete floors, and an endless succession of columns and girders. Lines of force stretching in front of you and down into the tunnel. Early morning in the subway is a special time. The station seemed cleaner, the air fresher. From 4:30 to 6:30 a.m. are the hours when the night and day people cross paths, with the tired partygoers, musicians, waitresses, janitors, night watchmen, pimps, and whores meet the early morning shift of workers, domestics, and students who have to travel a long way. He liked standing on the platform and riding the trains at that time. And that's what he misses most when he thinks about his job at the church. He likes the idea of an underground city, the sense of living in an artificial environment that might have been built after a nuclear holocaust, with long stretches of hallways, multi-level ramps, railings, and escalators. In some of the larger stations, they sell food, clothes, books, records, newspapers, magazines, and candy. You can buy a token, go into the subway, and travel anywhere under the city for years. You can live below the surface of the earth. Christianity's first expression in Rome was beneath the surface of the city, in the catacombs, where Christians buried their martyrs, in the great cities of the dead. Yesterday, he was having lunch in the solarium. The minute he saw me, tears came into his eyes. He was sitting in a wheelchair, a plastic tray in front of him. He took a a spoonful of grapefruit and dropped it in his milk. Then he poured his coffee into his soup. "What am I doing?" he said. "What am I doing?" Later, I asked him, "Do you want any more to eat?" He looked up. "First, I have to know what eating is." He said it with a smile, as if he were cracking a joke.
Team, I have not been to visit him. I have sent along some cards and letters. Also, I sent along some photographs of some of our special times together. I sent him a couple coloring books, okay, because he likes to color, and a lot of people think that's, again, they're going to make out that that's a silly thing. That's what a child does, but he likes to, you know, the man likes to color, so I gave him some coloring books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got him some sea monkeys, which he also enjoys, and also two videotapes, although I understand he's not allowed to have a videotape machine in his jail cell. So I don't know what he's doing with them, maybe looking at them. They're just a box.
Do you have any idea of the state of mind of O.J. At this time?
Well, he's very upset, but he's strong, you know? He's very strong, and he needs some comfort and love. But, and I hope he gets it.
Well, he certainly seems to be getting it in terms of the mail he's been receiving and thousands of letters of support from people all over the country. That must be reassuring to you.
Absolutely, because he knows, everybody knows that he's innocent.
Do you have any theories about who actually did commit this crime?
See, my theory is it was a double suicide.
Really?
And they was trying to frame... On their way out, they was trying to frame O.J. to make him have a miserable life, you know, because things weren't going well for them. So it was a double suicide.
That is a very interesting theory, and that's one that I have never heard before. How did they manage to pull it off?
They blooded themselves, okay, mm-hmm. Then got blood on the glove and threw it over into the yard,
mm-hmm.
In the other one, then went and messed up his truck, his Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got blood all up in it and all. And then went back to her place to do the final blow-by-blow killing procedures, which involved the knife that he had purchased earlier.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that they slashed themselves to death. Is that what...
Uh-huh, that's right. How come nobody exposed that possibility? That hasn't even been raised by the media. They didn't talk about that. Two white people trying to frame O.J. Simpson is what it could be, and I think it might have happened.
But look what they sacrificed, the two of them, in order to get O.J. I mean, that's quite...
They're very sick people, too, you know? Obviously, if they did this to themselves, they have a sickness.
Well, I can understand why Nicole might want to commit suicide, because she was involved directly with O.J. But why in the world would this young man want to kill himself?
Because he was in love with her and wanted to prove his love to her, and because he got paid to do it, too.
He got paid to do it?
Uh-huh.
He got paid to commit suicide?
That's part of my theory.
Is it the smoldering beauty of my purple eyes, the lean and mane of hair that I toss carelessly? Is it my long eyelashes? Is it my muscular volcanic energy? Is it my perfectly sculptured Greek body? Who who knows? But they all find me irresistible. They want to touch me and rub up against me. They want a hair from my head, an article of my clothing. They want me to breathe on them. Is it my suave, sweet, utterly charming, disarming, and yet unassuming down-to-earth style? Is it the quality of my mind? The endlessly amusing, sometimes profoundly moving stories I tell? Is it my command of language? The depth of my insights, the sheer scope and range of my knowledge, the synthesis of my intellect as it ranges over a wide field of topics, able to discuss the manufacture of extruded molybdenum, Renaissance printmaking, various schools of Japanese sword making under the Taranga shogunate, the tempered scale before Bach, the history of aniline dyes, North African leather curing techniques, the flora of the Western Appalachian slopes, comb filter developments in digital tuners, and subatomic particles attendant to the cluster of black holes as postulated by Hawking? Is it because I'm a world-class expert in bioluminescence and have developed my own species of fluorescent porcupines? All I know is that my presence in a room is electrifying. I can see desire burning hotly like coals in people's eyes when they look at me. I can see them undressing me. The smoldering gazes of women compulsively crossing and uncrossing their legs, men grinding their molars while sweat forms in hot beads on their brows, teenage girls digging their nails into the palms of their hands, their lips parted, their eyes wet with desire. I was a magnificent baby, with pearly white teeth, creamy peach-colored skin, hands and feet perfectly formed. My ears were small shells, my lips a red flower. My face recalled cherubim, the most beautiful of choiring angels. I was, in fact, a perfect Renaissance painting of a baby. In grade school, next to me, all the other children looked plain, awkward, ugly, overpowered by the radiance of my physical beauty. A number of them actually committed suicide. The notes they left behind mentioned me by name. They said, I can never be as beautiful as Joe. I can never be as perfectly realized as Joe. There's no point in living. The school was forced to organize seminars and focus groups, and the mayor appointed a board of eminent psychiatrists and social workers to raise the self-esteem of the children, which had been undermined by my presence. Yes, there is no one else like me. In the supermarket, I was at the counter when the checkout girl, looking at me, her pupils going wide and then up into her skull, fainted dead away. When I went to the cleaners to pick up my clothes, the woman behind the counter said she couldn't find them, but I was told by her 14-year-old nephew that in fact she had them at home and was keeping them for some votive or religious purpose. The very last time I took a taxi cab, the driver refused to let me out and drove me around back streets and freeways just for the pleasure of looking at me in the rearview mirror, never stopping anywhere until he ran out of gas. And when I climbed out of his cab, he pursued me, clutching at my clothes. The other day, I went to a coffee center and was set upon by a number of women who tore off my clothes and carried me to the Xerox machine, where they held me down against the glass in order to make multiple reproductions of my face, the undersides of my hands and feet, my buttocks, the soft under portion of my arms, the crook of my elbow, and the flesh behind my ears. Can you imagine how humiliating this was? It's impossible for anyone who hasn't lived in my skin to realize the moment-by-moment agony that I suffer on a daily basis.
We're giving social media a makeover.
How many tries does it take to get the perfect photo?
The average girl spends 3 hours a day using social media.
48% of teens report feeling lonely and less confident in themselves after using social media.
After the iPhone release in 2007, the depression rate in teens spiked.
To learn how to make social media a more positive place, go to MediaGirls.org. Follow Media Girls on Instagram and use the hashtag MGMakeover.
Well, I didn't even get to everything I brought, but how many hours do I have? I just said to Ryan, I probably have a good 30 hours of Joe Frank shows to pick from. I haven't even listened to them all myself. And there are so many more. Like I said, go sign up at joefrank.com and get a little more taste for the man who learned to paint these vivid pictures that pulled me in during his long run on KCRW in LA. He was also syndicated on stations elsewhere, including WFMU in New Jersey, which I often reference because it was the freeform station that I got pulled into that changed how I listened to everything. And Joe pulled me in there, and the rest is history. Oh, the radio. We just heard an excerpt from Joe's 1993 show, The Loved One, about a man who is plagued by people desiring him. That was from his 1993 series, In the Dark. Before that, we heard an interview with O.J. Simpson's valet from Joe's 1996 show, The O.J. Chronicles, from the Somewhere Out There series. That is that show also involves Joe Frank and his friend doing a live recording as they drive around recreating OJ's chase route in a Ford Bronco with a gun pointed at Joe Frank's head to see if anyone notices. Nobody seems fazed. And before that, we had a piece from possibly my favorite hour-long program of Joe's, the 1996 Joe Frank program, Fat Man Down, which is about a guy who's probably a little too smart for his own good, who comes apart as his life goes on, and the stories, the music, the pictures that are painted. I could only dream of someday having such an impact on you listeners. The best impact I'm going to have, though, is to get off of the air and hand you over to Ryan D. and the Music Savage Show here on WMFO Medford. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this little look at the life and work of Joe Frank. And I'll be back with a regular show next week here on In You All Along.